A citizen's arrest or cold-blooded murder? That is the choice before the jury in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. We've got the highlights from today's closing arguments. Which side made the better case? And then...
we got about 10 to 15 people down in the street. We also got multiple critical patients.
It would wind up being a lot more than that. Holiday cheer turned into screams of agony in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Children lining the streets, the local high school's marching band, and yet a speeding SUV left 5 dead and at least 48 injured, leaving many wondering, if we're not safe here, where are we safe? And the latest from the Gabby Petito investigation. 2 months after her remains were found, the case is still open and it is still active right now. Why is it taking so long for law enforcement to say case closed? Also tonight, you have heard the stories, you've seen the headlines, they've been everywhere. You think you know the secrets that Jeffrey Epstein took to his grave, but now comes Chasing Ghislaine, a jaw-dropping look at Epstein's lover, confidant, and alleged accomplice. Investigative journalist Vicky Ward joins me on this hour on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. It will be at least another day before the jury starts weighing the evidence in the Ahmaud Arbery killing. Judge Timothy Walmsley dismissed the jurors for the day after the prosecution and defense delivered their closing arguments. The lead prosecutor still gets to offer a rebuttal statement. She told the judge it would likely take her 2 hours to deliver it. The jury will hear that starting at 8:30 tomorrow morning and then presumably begin deliberations after that. But they already have a lot to think about. The prosecution and defense laid out two very different scenarios today. The defense arguing that the three men charged in Arbery's killing, Gregory and Travis McMichael and William Roddy Bryan Jr., had the right to perform a citizen's arrest because Arbery was a recurring intruder in the neighborhood.
But Mr. Arbery is now running down the street, running from the English residence. He's passing house after house after house on a nice Sunday afternoon. Is there any evidence that Mr. Arbery sought help, sought assistance from anyone in that neighborhood up to this point? Maybe you heard it. I didn't. But as he comes up to Mr. Bryan's residence, he starts coming by his house. Why isn't Mr. Arbery asking for help? Why isn't he calling out, hey, somebody call 911. There's crazy people after me. Maybe that's because Mr. Arbery doesn't want help.
The prosecution argued the opposite, saying the three men did not witness Arbery commit any crime and killed him because he wouldn't stop and talk to them.
They were detaining him for the police so that they could investigate and find the crime that he must have committed that day, because what is he? He's running down the street. They attacked him. They shot and killed him. They can't claim self-defense under the law because they were the initial unjustified aggressors and they started this.
And the prosecution's rebuttal argument begins tomorrow, 8:30 in the morning. Tune into News Nation's Morning in America. We will have full coverage there. But I want to turn now to this awful, awful tragedy in Wisconsin. The man suspected of fatally mowing down 5 people and injuring over 40 at a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin, has a checkered history with police that led right up to the moment he got behind the wheel of that red SUV we have all seen. Let's go right to News Nation's Kelly Beeson. Kelly, I was thinking today, you and I were together in Kenosha just on Friday for the Rittenhouse verdict. Now you're just an hour away in Waukesha at this terrible tragedy. Tell us the latest tonight. I can't imagine what a shock this must be for the people here. I mean, this was a Christmas parade. What's the mood like there on the ground?
You know what, Brian, as you know, when you arrive to a scene like this, it's a fluid situation. But what I can tell you is we were along that parade route. We were speaking with homeowners. We were speaking with business owners and people who were generally in the area that night. And all of them sort of gave me the same response. They said, we are shell-shocked. This came out of nowhere. And some people that I spoke with that we were saying, would you be comfortable speaking on camera about this night? They said, I don't even know if what I would tell you would make sense because I'm still trying to put this together in my own mind. So I think this has had a very big impact on this community, obviously, and the ripples are throughout Waukesha and throughout the country, really. When you hear about people who are innocently at a parade and then instantaneously losing their life, it's an extremely difficult story, Brian.
And I think, Kelly, what was so disturbing for me when I first started to see the images yesterday was that there are so many children involved in this. I mean, you had the marching band out there on the street. You had a dance troupe. Today we heard from the police chief that children are among the injured. What's the latest you know about these injuries, specifically with the kids?
Yeah. You're right, Brian. That is a very tragic piece of this story. Now, again, a fluid situation, but the latest numbers and the latest update that we received was that there were 18 children ages 3 to 16 that have been hospitalized, and 6 injured are juveniles now in the ICU. Doctors told us today that these injuries for all children range from bumps, bruises, scrapes, broken bones, all the way to much more serious injuries. Many of those children in the hospital tonight. And I think that's a big reason why you saw such an outpouring of support earlier this evening. There was a vigil held at a nearby park. This was the location, and hundreds of community members coming out, leaning on each other, lighting candles. There were people passing out flowers, some people passing out food. It was a real show of unity here in Waukesha. And everybody in this group leaning on prayer tonight. Brian.
Yeah, I can't imagine being at that vigil, how sad it must have been. I saw some images earlier. They actually had dump trucks and snow removal trucks out there blocking the road so that people would feel safe because of what they had been through with this red SUV just barreling into their parade. That is what they needed to feel safe tonight. Kelly, I want to play a witness that was there when this happened yesterday. Let's listen to what the witness said.
So I saw it strike the band that had just passed my apartment complex and plowed into at least 3 people, running over 2 of them. One of the 2 got up, the other one did not for quite some time. It kept going all the way down the block to People's Park, the stoplight, and continued straight through it, and that's all that I saw. And it continued to strike pedestrians and people along the way.
So, Kelly,
so you can imagine the trauma
witness
involved with that.
Yeah, I was
I'm
just going to say
Brian,
the same
ahead.
Thing as you. I mean, no, yeah, absolutely. The trauma is unbelievable, and I know you were with a lot of these people that had to experience this, and you were with them at a vigil tonight. What was this vigil like?
You know, this vigil, Brian, was very, everybody was somber, but everybody, you could just feel this incredible sense of unity. I feel like when events like this happen, there's so often this aftershock of people just wanting to gather. They want to see their neighbors. They want to see their friends. They want to gather and pray. They want to also thank the first responders. That was a big piece of a press conference earlier today when police came out and they spoke with the press about what had happened last night. They said that these first responders were on the scene immediately, acting professionally, and that they gave the children and everybody involved immediate and the best care that they could receive. And that, I think, was comforting to a lot of people who showed up here tonight. But again, this vigil centered around prayer, centered around community members showing one another that they are here for one another, and Waukesha will get through this together.
And I think that's one of the most amazing things about all of this is the first responders. You know, they were all already at this parade. You had the police who were out there for the parade. The fire chief said he was also there. I mean, I think It's very lucky that they were there because they were able to spring into action so quickly. They didn't have to respond and race over there. So many of them were already right there along the parade route.
They were right there along the parade route. There were families who were saying, we were speaking with some witnesses who said, I had my family right up against the parade route, and I grabbed my daughter and threw her out of the way. My wife was behind me. I mean, we heard multiple stories like this throughout the day today. I mean, just gut-wrenching stories. And I think that there were so many people, not only the first responders who did such an excellent job, but also, you know, your everyday heroes who came in, fathers who saw children on the ground, who started administering aid where they could, or carrying children to ambulances where they saw fit. And those kinds of stories, I think, are what we're going to start to uncover and hear more about in the days ahead.
Yeah, I heard today a story, Kelly, that police officers were literally putting victims into the back of their patrol cars and driving them to area hospitals. And the same thing with just regular people who are out there along the parade, rescuing people, taking them to hospitals. So really incredible. But I want to get into something else, because this has troubled me all day long. And that is this suspect, Daryl Brooks, and his past. He has quite a criminal history that has come out today. And I want to just sort of run you through this, because when you look at all of the charges, it's really sort of unbelievable. He was involved in a domestic issue prior to the crash. We know that. Second degree recklessly endangering safety. Felon in possession of a firearm. Resisting or obstructing an officer. Bail jumping. Endangering safety. Disorderly conduct and battery, and we now find out that he posted a $1,000 cash bond and that he was out on bond when this all happened, according to the police. He was out on bond when he was in that SUV, and he was apparently running from some kind of domestic situation, and that is why the police say he was on the run and went into this crowd. Kelly, what do we know about that? Are they giving any more information about what he was on the run from?
You know, we heard from police earlier today, and you're exactly right with all of those charges and that criminal history, Brian. We heard from police earlier today that he was allegedly involved in a domestic dispute and fleeing that dispute. Now, again, all of this is under investigation, so we want to be careful with the information and the facts right now. However, what we heard from police was that there is no terrorist threat here, because I think that's where a lot of minds went when you initially hear of an incident like this. However, they were quick to say that they do not believe that this suspect was allegedly driving through this crowd for any other reason other than to flee an alleged domestic dispute. However, a lot remains to be seen in this case. They also mentioned that they do not believe that the suspect knew any of the people that he impacted or allegedly impacted in this incident. So, again, the days ahead, we're going to be learning more. However, for the current moment, police have been very adamant about saying there is no threat of terrorism to the Waukesha community.
Yeah, and I think that was a bit of a relief, of course, when you always hear that they don't believe it is terrorism related. You feel some sense of relief, okay, this wasn't part of a bigger plan or something like that. But when you think of all the people who were hurt and killed, even if it's not terrorism, I mean, the fact that this guy just kept driving, and the police chief today said that they even shot at the car to try and stop him. I mean, what are people saying, like, at the vigil? Are people talking about this? Are people upset that this guy was even out of jail?
You know, I think at the vigil tonight, to be quite frank with you, Brian, people are just trying to absorb the shock of this. And I don't think that anger has set in, or at least it hasn't surfaced here just yet. I do know that I think right now the immediate response from not only law enforcement, but community members here is, let's rally around all of these people who have been impacted, who are involved. You know, we know that four of the people who were killed were older women who were dancing in this parade. They were a part of an elderly dance troupe, and there were some posts on social media saying that they were the light of the dance troupe. Another gentleman who had passed away, 81 years old, so many children right now in the hospital fighting so hard tonight, and I think that's where the focus has been for these last 24 plus hours. However, I'm sure as time progresses, we will get to those very important questions.
Yeah, and you're right, Kelly, that is where the focus should be now. I saw those grandparents that were killed. I saw photos of them earlier. And to think about the kids in the hospital tonight, I know you've been busy. I know these stories aren't easy to cover. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. I know we'll get back with you if anything develops. So thank you, Kelly. We'll get back with you soon.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay. Well, when we come back, how do you prepare for the unimaginable? And that is the unimaginable. One former FBI agent tells us what you need to know to stay safe in crowded events. We'll have that coming up. And also, still ahead, the burning questions we all still have about the Gabby Petito case. I have the questions, too. We're going to dive into them together. That's coming up later in the show.
Everyone was in shock, and then everyone started screaming.
People were laying in the road stretched out over four or five blocks. At first, I thought maybe a drunk driver didn't stop, but then someone said they definitely did it deliberately. I feel like I'm watching a movie and it's not real life because I've never seen anything this bad before.
So scary to think that that is real life, the scenes there from the ground in Waukesha. Joining us now is former FBI agent and bomb technician Jim Maxwell, whose specialty is active shooter training. Jim, you heard in the last segment there, I was talking about the suspect's criminal history. I think it is just so infuriating for people when they hear about these guys who have done so many bad things and that they're still out and they're able to do this. I'm sure as a former FBI agent, that's got to just enrage you.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the system failed the public here in this case. I think a lot of self-scrutiny is going to come down the line here as far as how these matters are handled in the future. But this time, I think there's no getting around it. The ball was dropped.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the fact that we were digging into his records more and that he's accused of trying to run over his girlfriend with the same red SUV, that's one of the things he's been accused of in the past. And now this. It's just unbelievable. But let me move on here, because I know your specialty was active shooter training. But from what I've read, a speeding SUV can really be just as dangerous as gunshots. Can you explain that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, early in my career, I was involved in a shooting that involved a vehicle coming at myself and the officers attempting to arrest an individual, and shots were fired. And, you know, you're completely justified in that matter. It's just as dangerous as being shot at to having a 3,000, 4,000 pound car coming at you. And it's evident by the carnage that was left behind yesterday. Five people dead, 40 injured with one vehicle. This guy was intent on hurting people, it would seem.
And I heard the police chief say earlier, Jim, that they had barricades there. They had some kind of barricades out there at the event. I've been at some of these events, and the barricades seem to vary. You go to some, and you can tell, wow, that is something that could really stop a moving car. And then you go to some, and it's just a very small little gate. What do you suspect they had out there that this guy was able to get through?
Well, in this particular case, this parade is what we would call a soft target. And there really is not a lot of preparation in protecting against something like this type of event. The barricades that were up there yesterday that I saw on the footage were barricades to keep people back, not vehicles, and to outline the route. There are barricades out there that are commercially available, like Jersey barricades, which are made out of concrete. And in some cases, the intersections are blocked off with heavy trucks and vehicles. In New York, you'll see at some parades that the intersections will have garbage trucks or large dump trucks to impede any vehicle trying to get into that area. In this particular case, holiday Christmas parade, there really is not much pre-planning that anybody would think that this type of event would happen. I think down the road now, future planners are going to take this into consideration and probably reroute parades and so they can be conducted in a safe manner where they can, people can be protected, both the crowd watching the parade as well as the participants.
And you mentioned it. I mean, this was a Christmas parade. I grew up going to parades like this with my mom and my grandma. I mean, this is what we do, and we should be able to feel safe, it seems like. I mean, what's your message to people who obviously this is the time of year we're going out to these sort of events? Is there anything you can do to take as a precaution?
Well, when we teach classes on active shooter, there are two things that we emphasize: situational awareness. Be aware of where you are. My daughter always laughs. She said, Dad, every time I go into a public place, I look for the exits because that's what you tell me what to do in case there's an emergency. Well, situational awareness and showing poise in a stressful situation. We found that in an analysis of past incidents, the people who keep their head in these stressful situations are the people who survive these situations. In this particular case, I would venture to guess that a lot of the victims were blindsided, that they didn't even see this car coming while the parade was going on. But those two things, I think, for anybody, it's good advice for anybody going to a public event. Be aware of where you are, where the exits are, and if you had to make an emergency exit, do you know where to go? Do you have a plan? Or will you, if you're separated from your loved ones, do you know how to get, find a rally point and meet up later on? These are all things that in this day and age, I think you have to talk about if you're going to go out to a public venue.
And you mentioned staying calm. One of the, and I can't say I necessarily stay calm. I'd probably be freaking out too. But one of the first things I noticed in the videos from today or from yesterday was the screaming. I mean, you immediately notice the panic. People go into full on panic mode. And I guess if you can stay calm, that really increases your chances of getting out of there, it seems like.
Exactly. We've looked at these situations, and the people who remain calm make good decisions. They see what's unfolding in front of them, and they can make an appropriate decision. Now, granted, everybody reacts to these things differently, but this is something you have to train yourself. You ask yourself the question when you're in a minor car accident: are you the person that jumps out of the car yelling and screaming and pointing the finger, or are you the person that gets out of the car and asks, "Is everybody okay? Do I need to call an ambulance? Can I see your license and registration?" Everybody reacts to these things differently, but I think it's something that if you're a type A personality, you have to kind of train yourself to subdue those initial reactions and take a look at what's going on and make a proper decision on how to handle it.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to just try and stay calm in those situations. Well, thank you, Jim Maxwell. Really appreciate your time tonight. Really, really good advice. We'll see you soon. Okay, coming up next. More than 2 months after Gabby Petito's remains were found in Wyoming and a month after Brian Laundrie was found dead, both cases are still open and still active. Are we getting any closer to answers? We're going to dive into it coming up next. Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. Remembering Gabby Petito, the city of Northport, Florida today unveiled a memorial bench in Gabby's honor. It is covered in steel butterflies, a favorite of Gabby's, and a plaque which includes a Bible passage, Matthew 18:20, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them." Aaron Betzner, the designer who worked with Gabby's family to make the bench happen, says he went with a three-person design instead of the usual two-person because he wanted it to be a place where people can come and sit, reflect on their own life, reflect on Gabby, kind of a little sanctuary space. It's located near the Northport City Hall. That is where that makeshift memorial to Gabby once stood. We were out there so many days. Supporters from across the country traveled to visit the memorial, bringing teddy bears, flowers, posters, and all sorts of mementos. They also came to Northport to try and find some answers. So many answers that we still need even right now, 2 months after Gabby's remains were found in Wyoming and a month after Brian Laundrie's was found dead. Both cases remain open and active right now, still to this day. I'm joined by retired FBI agent Jennifer Coffendoffer. Jennifer, you and I were out there together in Northport. We were in the swamp together. We became friends from that experience. We were getting new information every single day, basically, updates either from police or the FBI or other sources. And then basically, boom, it all just stopped. And we've learned really nothing new in quite some time, yet we know the investigations are ongoing. What do you think the holdup is?
Well, initially, Brian, to understand why there is this slow incoming of information, we have to understand that initially, up until they found Brian Laundrie's body, this was a grand jury investigation. 23 people seated, a prosecutor, assistant United States attorney specifically involved, presenting evidence to them through witnesses such as FBI agents, actual witnesses that knew things, coroner that would come in and give information. So this is a very long and tedious process. There were grand jury subpoenas issued for cell records, for bank records, for CCTV, and more than that, you know, everything that encompassed that investigation. So it takes days for that information to be compiled and then to be returned by an FBI agent who presents that information to the grand jury. All that was going on prior to them finding the remains of Brian Laundrie.
But Jennifer, the FBI never officially, up until this point, connected Brian Laundrie to Gabby Petito's death. Of course, they've called him a person of interest, and you know, we've sort of put the pieces together. But don't they have an obligation at some point to come clean with the public and say, look, we think Brian did it, and this is why? Because if they don't do that, aren't we all sort of left to wonder, you know, what really happened?
Absolutely. I think actually it was really semantics when we're talking about a person of interest. Brian Laundrie was definitely the subject of this investigation from all the evidence that was out there publicly, and that was supported, I believe, by evidence that was further collected by the FBI. The FBI will make a determination, not obviously through a grand jury now, because we don't need a true bill returned or a no bill returned by a grand jury. They don't need to find probable cause. This case is not going to trial. But they need to let the public know, or if not, we have, in a sense, somebody who committed this murder out there. So the FBI will release some sort of presser indicating who they believe was responsible for this crime.
And every week, Jennifer, I make all of my beat calls on this case. I call, you know, the Northport Police Department. Last thing they told me was that they can't release any more information or any of our records requests because it's still technically an open investigation with the FBI. I also call and contact the FBI. The last thing they told me was, continue to check our Twitter for updates, which I actually sort of thought was interesting because they didn't just say no comment. They said continue to check our Twitter, which I thought, okay, great. Maybe something's going to come on the Twitter. The other thing that I'm always checking, like obsessively almost every day, is I go on Pacer, which for those of you that don't know, that's the federal court system, and I check the bank fraud case out of Wyoming. Brian Laundrie had that federal bank fraud case out of Wyoming, and that is still listed as active. That has not been closed, and it's still open. So my question is, why is that still active if we presume that Brian Laundrie is dead?
Right. Well, that has to maintain being opened until a death certificate is obtained, the actual proof and acknowledgement that Brian Laundrie is dead. I also do want to give kudos, Brian, to the FBI at this point, because They got the case on September 19th, and if I recall correctly, it was about September 23rd that an indictment was issued for the use, unlawful use of an access device. And so from that point, they very quickly charged him with a crime so they could get a full-on manhunt for him initiated.
Is there any chance, Jennifer, that the reason we're not hearing much right now is because they are still investigating the laundries?
Well, that has to be a part of this investigation. Look, Brian, you know, if they find that the laundries covered up this matter in any way, they could be held responsible. Let me give you a couple scenarios. For an example, if the clothing that he wore when this crime was committed, again, making the educated presumption that Brian Laundrie was responsible for this crime, if they somehow got rid of this, his clothing, or any indicia of the crime, they could be held responsible. Also, if they erased text messages or something where Brian implicated himself in any way to them, all of these things could be used against them potentially. Do I think that they're probably going to be charged with the evidence we have out in the public? No, but the FBI could have more information pertaining to an obstruction charge.
And one of the top questions I get, and I know you're also very active on Twitter and we're sort of inundated with messages all the time about the Gabby Petito case because people want more information. One of the most popular ones I get is about the notebook that was found in the Carlton Reserve near Brian Laundrie's remains. The last we heard was that they thought it was salvageable, but we don't know what messages were in it. Do you think there's going to be important information in that notebook?
Well, I have to tell you, in my career, it's been amazing what the FBI lab can do with information that has been written. They can get ink that seemingly is gone to jump back off the page. I've seen pages of notebook and paper that looks blank, but they can detect indentations that when you write, indent into the paper, and they can come and they can make those messages pop right off the page. It's amazing what they can do. We don't know the condition that the writing in this notebook was in when it was recovered. Was it pencil? Was it pen? Was it washed away? And I believe the FBI is using all their chemical techniques and other techniques to get everything they can out of that notebook. Depending on how much was written in there, Brian, you can imagine it may be a long, tedious process, but they can do it.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it seems like they've got the tools needed to do that. I just want to mention, you know, I've been in touch with the Petitos. Obviously, they're still going through incredible grief, but they've now got this mission and this platform moving forward to help others, other victims of domestic violence, other missing person cases. I mean, I know, Jennifer, you've also been touched by their story, and I think it's worth mentioning that they're now going into this phase of their own grief where they want to help others. And I think, you know, it's incredible. You see there the Gabby Petito Foundation. You can go to their website, and they're really starting to get going with this thing. And I know you've worked with a lot of victims' families over the years, Jennifer, but I'm sure you agree it's special that they're going this direction.
Oh, it truly is. And what I've really liked being a part of and seeing happen is this whole Twitter community come alive and do whatever they can to help in other cases. I know of a specific case where the Twitter community was called together and they called a department that was responsible for investigating a missing person, and an Amber Alert hadn't been issued. And they just called and sort of inundated this department in hopes that this public outcry would help facilitate an Amber Alert. Now, I don't know how much that played into it, but I think it played into it somewhat. And I think it's wonderful what Gabby Petito, the foundation, this whole movement that's began where people involved in the cyber world are helping in these investigations. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, it is incredible. You and I have made a lot of friends out there that have done a lot of good. People at home behind their computers, literally getting to work. And you know who you are if you're watching, and pushing police departments to do Amber Alert. So it's incredible, the community that's been formed. So thank you, Jennifer, for being part of that. Thanks for being on the show tonight. And I'll see you soon.
As always, thank you, Brian.
Okay, well, still ahead tonight, the jury is picked and opening statements are set for next Monday in U.S. versus Ghislaine Maxwell. But you don't have to wait till then to hear the sad and salacious details of the life Maxwell shared with Jeffrey Epstein. The journalist behind the brand new docuseries, Chasing Ghislaine, she joins me next. Welcome back. A woman who was born into privilege, power, honor, wealth is standing trial in New York on charges that could send her to prison for life. Ghislaine Maxwell is accused of finding, enticing, and grooming underage girls for her sometime boyfriend and longtime employer, Jeffrey Epstein. We've all heard that name. And if you think their relationship couldn't possibly be boiled down to the one sentence I just read, you're right. Vicky Ward knows that relationship and both of those people as well as anyone ever has or will. She is a best-selling author and investigative journalist whose docuseries Chasing Ghislaine premieres tonight on Discovery Plus. I've seen clips. It looks awesome. I can't wait to watch the whole thing. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. Let's start with the first question that I really had. Why the title Chasing Ghislaine? Chasing, a very interesting word there.
Well, do you remember, Brian, after Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his jail cell, the question of where was Ghislaine Maxwell dominated our headlines for a year until she was found in quite dramatic circumstances, living sort of on the cliffs up in New Hampshire. But I also think that long before that, really all through the period of her life in New York, which is where I first met her in the 1990s, she was an enigma. She was someone who would breeze in to the kind of British expat kind of parties that I attended. You know, the British expat world in New York is a small one. We all know each other. And she would sort of name drop important politicians, rich people she'd been spending time with, traveling with, and then she would disappear again. She was always this sort of exotic figure, and you were left wondering, what does she actually do all day? Is it really this jet-set extraordinary life? It was curious. So that is why it's called Chasing Ghislaine. It's a question, who is this woman?
Yeah, absolutely. There is this mystery about her. I mean, we've heard so much about Jeffrey Epstein over the years, and there's really enough evidence to say, I mean, he's a pretty bad guy. We've seen all the evidence and heard from the victims. But with Ghislaine, there's always been this sort of question, was she also abused by Epstein? Was she, or was she also as bad as he was?
Right. So, to sort of push back a little bit, one of the reasons I wanted to make this documentary when Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested was precisely because I knew, given that I had been assigned to write a very deep dive profile of Jeffrey Epstein back in 2002, I knew that his story was a lot more complicated than just being a sex offender, as horrific as that is. There was much more to Jeffrey Epstein. He was a master manipulator. He was a con artist. He was an embezzler. He was possibly an arms dealer. He was probably a spy. And he was a math teacher. And I knew that Ghislaine Maxwell held the key to possibly unlocking the riddle of who he really was, because the real story is much more complicated and it involves many more people. And one of the things I really wanted to get at was the men. And she, you know, we're going to hear tomorrow. There's a court hearing tomorrow, pre-trial court hearing, whether or not emails are going to be allowed in court.
It always is. Sorry to interrupt you, but it always is more complicated, it seems, than what you just read in the paper or a magazine. And that's why I want to talk to you more in a second. Sit tight for a second. After a break, I want to look ahead to the culmination of everything we've just been talking about. We're going to have more on that coming up.
A ball of energy, a real live wire, that it felt exciting to be in her company. She told fantastically funny stories. She had quite a raucous sense of humor, lots of self-deprecating humor. And her conversation was sort of peppered with famous names of, you know, extraordinarily powerful people.
And my guest is journalist, author, and commentator Vicky Ward, whose three-part docuseries on Ghislaine Maxwell debuts tonight on Discovery Plus. I want to ask you, Vicky, her trial now, the sex trafficking charges, you seem to know this situation better than anyone. How do you think this is going to play out? Do you think she's guilty?
Listen, she's pled not guilty. It's up for a jury to decide that, Brian. But what I think we do know, and I know from my reporting, is what her defense strategy is going to be. And past is prologue. What I mean by that is that when Ghislaine Maxwell's father died in controversial circumstances, her two brothers were charged of helping their dead father basically rob his former employees of their pension funds to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, this was in the early 1990s in London. Nobody before that trial thought that Ghislaine Maxwell's two brothers were going to be acquitted. But their defense was to say that they themselves were victims of a brutal father. Their own mother took the stand and said that. And I think you're going to see Ghislaine Maxwell say that she was a victim of Jeffrey Epstein. Kevin and Ian Maxwell also shredded the credibility of the government's witnesses. And again, I think
sorry to interrupt you, Vicky, but I think it'll also be interesting to see, you know, how this all plays out. Obviously, her lawyers have said that she's only being tried because Epstein cannot. So thank you so much, Vicky. Sorry to cut you off. Can't wait to watch the entire thing. It's on be streaming now on Discovery Plus. Also, tune in tomorrow for a special episode of Banfield. This is big. Ashley's one-on-one sit down with Kyle Rittenhouse. We are asking him your questions. That's going to be tomorrow night. Be sure to head to NewsNationNow.com. Submit your questions. Thanks for letting me fill in, Ashley. She'll be back tomorrow night.